Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the White House. My name is Maria Towne, and I'm an associate director in the Office of Public Engagement. Thank you all for joining us for today's event. And to get it started, I'd like to introduce Senior Advisor to the President, Valerie Jarrett.
Thank you so much, Maria, and good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the White House. We are delighted to have you all here. And we're here to talk about how we can make our criminal justice system work better for all Americans. But I wanted to spend a moment just touching on the tragedies yesterday in Baton Rouge. Obviously, our hearts go out to the families of the three officers who were killed and the three who were wounded. I spent much of yesterday speaking with the governor, the mayor, and the police chief, just trying to figure out what had happened, and there was a lot of misinformation. But as the facts unfolded, what became clear is that somebody motivated by evil decided to basically ambush people who are putting their lives on the line each and every day to serve and protect all of us. And as the president said yesterday, that is completely unacceptable. It's not who we are. And we have to all, individually and collectively, speak out. And obviously, it's more painful than ever because it's followed right on the heels of what happened in Dallas as well. And so going into the summer where it's hot and people's temperament sometimes is frayed, I think it's always good to remind everyone that we have to be voices of calm and voices of reason. And there is plenty of reason to demonstrate, but those demonstrations have to remain peaceful. So even as we push for reforms in our criminal justice system, reforms which are mightily needed, we need to make absolutely clear that there is no justification for violence against law enforcement. And as the president has said repeatedly, there is no contradiction between honoring incredibly courageous police officers who are doing their jobs each and every day while lifting up the disparities that we know exist in our criminal justice system. We can hold both truths at the same time. That's why, as we grieve, it is so critical that we continue this important conversation. So often when we discuss the disparities in our criminal justice system, all too rarely do we discuss the impact of the criminal justice system on people with disabilities. That's why the report released today by the Center for American Progress is so important. And as you'll hear this afternoon, as CAPS Rebecca Vallis reports, people with disabilities are dramatically overrepresented in our nation's prisons and our jails. Of the 2.2 million people behind bars, 32% of prisoners and 40% of jailed inmates reported having at least one disability. Prisoners were nearly three times more likely, and jailed inmates were more than four times more likely than the general population to report having at least one disability. This trend, as we know, starts in the classroom. Students with disabilities receive the highest rates of out-of-school suspension among student subgroups. They are twice as likely to receive an out-of-school suspension as their peers, and students with disabilities represent a quarter of the students arrested and referred to law enforcement, even though they only represent 12% of the population. For many students with disabilities, the issue we see in discipline actually starts with identification and how we early address the needs of students by individualized education programs. While today's event is going to focus primarily on adults with disabilities in our criminal justice system, shutting down the school-to-prison pipeline for students with disabilities is a critical piece of the puzzle, and so I want to spend just a moment to touch on that. The impact of suspensions and other exclusionary discipline practices on students is devastating. And honestly, I've never understood why people thought that the right thing to do when people misbehave is to send them out of school. We want them to stay in school. Students who are suspended are more likely to be retained in grade or to drop out. An exclusionary discipline feeds that school-to-prison pipeline. Research also shows that very few suspensions are for acts of violence or violations of state statutes. And so we have to ensure that the punishment fits the infraction and to go into our education system with the attitude that we want to keep everybody inside the classroom. Wherever we can, we should address behavioral needs as early as possible in childhood as we can. With the alarming rates of people with disabilities behind bars and the disproportionate number of students with disabilities entering the school-to-prison pipeline, it's clear that it is essential that the disability community be an active partner in our criminal justice efforts, and that's why you're here today. When President Obama laid out his administration's principles for criminal justice reform, he emphasized the need to focus on the community, the courtroom, and the cell block. All of this is predicated on the simple belief that criminal justice reform, if done properly, will actually make our communities safer. First, we must focus on the community. And as you'll hear from Sheriff Kotu John from Middlesex County, Massachusetts, following a long history of disinvestment in the community-based treatments and services there, too many jails have become social service providers of last resort, with devastating consequences for individuals with disabilities who have no business being in jail in the first place. Second, we must focus on the courtroom. Poor Americans can spend weeks or months in jail for one reason and one reason only, because they are poor and they can't afford the fees, the fines, and the cost of bail. Today, Diane Smith Howard of the National Disability Rights Network will discuss how people with mental illness and cognitive disabilities often become involved in the system because of offenses that are directly related to their disabilities and can be denied the accommodations that they need to receive just outcomes. And third, we have to focus on the cell block. David Carlson of the AVID Prison Project, is it AVID or AVID? AVID, thank you. Prison Project will discuss how poor conditions and lack of accommodations are sadly widespread in our nation's correctional facilities. Now, the president is very proud of what we have accomplished so far in many of the areas that I just outlined. So, for example, he has commuted 348 sentences, more than the past seven presidents combined, of people where he felt that the punishment didn't in any way fit the crime. People who were serving life sentences, a young man who I met who was sentenced for three minor drug infractions, all nonviolent, to life in prison. He did not need to be behind our bars. He needed help. The federal government has taken steps to be a model employer by implementing fair chance hiring for federal jobs and advancing disability recruitment in the hiring here at the federal government, something that the president committed to from day one, and he's very proud of our record, not just for what we're doing, but because it's a role model for what we expect from both the private and public sector around the country. We have invested in mentoring and job training and new reentry programs. We have brought together leaders in the private sector and encouraged them, as well as those in higher education and encouraged them, and folks in state and local government and encouraged them all to catalyze reform from banning the box to better diversionary programs. But let's face it, we also need comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level. And it is one of the areas where 7.5 years in, I am still optimistic that on a bipartisan basis, Congress will act. There are strong bipartisan bills in both the House and the Senate, and we were heartened to hear last week Speaker Ryan commit that he intends to move it out of the House in September. And we know right now, based on all of the research we've done, that those bills would pass and the president could sign them, and particularly they would help nonviolent drug offenders avoid the mandatory minimum sentences that they're under today. We would take resources and put them back into ensuring our communities are safe, ensuring that people receive the treatment and the job training and the education that they need while they're incarcerated, so that when they leave prison, they can hit the ground running and be law-abiding members of society with opportunities, as opposed to falling victim to the revolving door. So I'm grateful for the leadership of the disability community on these issues, a wide range of issues, from the statement of support for the Sentencing Reform Act from the National Council on Independent Living and Disability Rights Networks, thank you for that, to the numerous efforts to raise awareness of the intersection between disabilities and the criminal justice system, to ensuring over and over again that we're working closely with organizations such as ARC, AUCD, AVID, and Respectability, to the state-focused efforts for organizations such as Disability Rights of North Carolina that's working to end solitary confinement for people with serious mental illnesses. I should note that the president also instructed his attorney general to do an analysis of the solitary confinement at the federal level, and she concluded that we should use it sparingly, never for children or juveniles, and that we should ensure that adults who are in solitary confinement are not there because we're trying to separate them from the general population, because all too often people with disabilities, the LGBT community, and youth are put in solitary confinement allegedly to keep them safer, but actually it creates all kinds of other mental health challenges that are hard to overcome. So that's an important part of the president's record as well. But the reality we know is that the clock is ticking right here in Washington, and we are all acutely aware that the president's time in office is coming to a close, and so we want to do everything within our power to ensure that Congress moves forward on its responsibility to pass reforms by September. As I'm reminded being here, making our community safer and healthier does take us all working together. And I'm so thankful that you are leading in the innovation, the important work necessary at the county level, from the state level, from the national level. All of us have to work together to ensure the reforms that are put in place are helping not some Americans, but all Americans. So to continue our effort here today, I'd like to turn it over to my dear friend and colleague, Rebecca Coakley. She's the executive director of the National Council on Disabilities. She has been a champion for people with disabilities throughout the president's time in office and long before. She's a terrific person, a great mom, and my dear friend. Rebecca, please come up.
I'd like to go ahead and invite our panelists up. Oh, this is really loud. And we're going to do really brief introductions for this esteemed panel. I am thrilled to have them all here today. It was a pleasure pulling all of this work together with all of you. To my right is Sheriff Kutujan. Sheriff Kutujan is the sheriff of Middlesex County, the largest county in Massachusetts and one of the most populated in the United States. Prior to 5 years with the sheriff's office, he served as a prosecutor and later as an elected member of the Massachusetts legislature, where he held a number of leadership positions. He's a designated member of the Massachusetts Council of State Governments Justice Center Working Group and a founding member of Law Enforcement Leaders to Reduce Crime and Incarceration. Next to him is the amazing Jamila Morgan. Jamila is the Arthur Lyman Fellow at the ACLU National Prison Project. At NPP, she litigates federal class action prison condition cases under the Eighth Amendment. In addition, she works on the ACLU's Stop Solitary campaign, seeking to end the practice of long-term isolation in our nation's prisons, jails, and juvenile detention centers through public policy reform, legislation, litigation, and public education. The third esteemed panelist is Rebecca Vallis, who's the managing director of the Poverty to Prosperity Program at the Center for American Progress. She began her anti-poverty career working directly with low-income individuals and their communities with a focus on people with disabilities and those with criminal records as an attorney and a policy advocate for community legal services in Philly. She was twice named one of Forbes' 30 Under 30 for law and policy, and I like to refer to her as the Jedi Master of Poverty Research. And hopefully somebody tweets that. I will say the hashtag CJ reform for PWD, not for PWDS, but CJ reform for PWD. And then our final panelist is David Wilkinson, the director of the White House Office of Social Innovation and Civic Participation. He leads the White House efforts to identify and scale better, more effective social solutions, advancing the president's priorities that strengthen communities and enable upward economic mobility. This involves identifying programs that work better through the use of data and evidence, as well as scaling what works through smarter use of federal resources and cross-sector collaboration. I think this table right here is a perfect example of that cross-sector collaboration. I'm going to go ahead and jump right in because I know our time is limited. And so I have a couple of key questions for each of you. And then I'm hoping to, you know, wrap it with one broad question and then being able to open it up to the audience. And I suspect, or I expect, that Maria will be monitoring our time judiciously. So first I'm going to turn to Rebecca Vallis and say, Rebecca, teeing up, can you give us a sense of the report that you guys put out today? You know, a short version emphasizing, you know, what the key areas were and where you were looking to go with it.
Happy to provide the Cliff's Notes, and thank you for not calling me the other Rebecca. I will happily take Jedi Master.
I can start referring to you as that going forward.
Only if I get to call you that. First of all, just thank you so much for everyone who's here today, to the administration for holding this really important conversation at an intersection that is all too rarely discussed. I am optimistic that today is the start of that changing. A huge thank you to Valerie Jarrett for her remarks earlier, and to the amazing one and only Maria Town, who really deserves some sleep after today. Yes. So I think that there's incredibly broad and bipartisan, really transpartisan, agreement that it is long past time to overhaul our nation's criminal justice system, that it's time to close the book on mass incarceration and over-criminalization. There's also increasingly wide awareness that certain populations have been hardest hit by our nation's experiment with mass incarceration. Communities of color, of course, residents of high poverty neighborhoods, LGBT individuals, but too rarely discussed is the impact of the criminal justice system on people with disabilities. And that's why CAP is so pleased to be partnering with the White House and with so many organizations in this room to be part of today's conversation. As you heard from Valerie Jarrett, people with disabilities are dramatically overrepresented in our nation's prisons and in our nation's jails. And I'm going to repeat one of the statistics that she mentioned because it really does bear repeating. And that is that according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, people behind bars in prisons are nearly three times as likely, and people behind bars in jails are more than four times as likely to report having at least one disability compared to the general population. Fully half of women in jails have at least one disability. Now, a big part of the story here, as many people in this room, leaders in the disability world, know all too well, a big part of the story is deinstitutionalization. The past 60 years have happily seen widespread closure of state mental hospitals and other institutions that used to serve people with disabilities in large numbers and not terribly well. Now, while this is widely regarded as a tremendously positive development, the shift was not accompanied by the public investment that was needed to ensure the availability of community-based alternatives. And so as a result, while people with disabilities are no longer living in large numbers in institutions, too many have been swept up into the criminal justice system, and the United States has effectively traded one form of mass institutionalization for another. Now, in addition to making up a disproportionate share of the incarcerated population in this country, people with disabilities are especially likely to be the victims of police-involved killings. And the tragic events of the past few weeks have rightly reignited that national conversation around policing reform. Freddie Gray, Eric Garner, Christiana Coignard, and Robert Ethan Saylor, all individuals with disabilities who lost their lives during interactions with law enforcement that went wrong, are but four high-profile examples of a sadly commonplace occurrence. And while data are extremely limited, something that you're going to hear about, I'm sure, from my colleague to my left in just a minute, one study does estimate that people with disabilities comprise one-third to one-half of all individuals who are the victims of police-involved fatalities. And according to an investigation by the Washington Post, one quarter of the individuals fatally shot by police in 2015 were people with mental illness. Now, our nation's courts are in many ways the epicenter of our justice system, but as the National Center for Access to Justice in New York, as well as advocates at HEARD and other leading organizations in this space have documented, lack of accessibility and failure to provide needed accommodations under the ADA are widespread, and this is also something you're going to hear about extensively on the second panel from my colleague at AVID. People who are deaf are routinely denied interpreters in court proceedings. In some states, courts are even permitted to charge people money for their own interpreters. Precious few states have systems in place for people with disabilities to even request needed accommodations. And denials of interpreters can lead to wrongful arrests, even convictions. Christine Stein is a story that everyone needs to know, a deaf resident from Jamestown, North Dakota. She called 911 using a video relay system. She was asking for help with a man who was experiencing crisis in her apartment. But what happened, according to a lawsuit that she has filed, is that the cops ended up arresting her because she was not given an interpreter and wasn't able to explain to them without that interpreter what had happened. Because she was denied that interpreter, she ultimately was brought before a judge, spent weeks without being able to clear up what had happened. It was only when she was finally able to meet with an interpreter weeks later that she was able to clear the situation up and have charges dismissed. Then there's the cell block. While behind bars, people with disabilities are often deprived of needed medical care as well as supports, services, accommodations, despite longstanding federal disability laws such as the Americans with Disabilities Act, which we're commemorating the 26th anniversary of this month. And as you'll hear in greater detail from other speakers, many individuals with disabilities are held in solitary confinement as a substitute for needed and appropriate accommodations. The AVID Prison Project's important report released in June, which you'll hear more about later today, documents one case example after another of inmates denied needed medications, even denied prosthetic limbs, people sustaining injuries because they weren't given access to accessible showers, toilets, and the like. I could go on. And finally, and importantly, because this is almost never discussed, is reentry. People with disabilities already face unemployment rates as high as three times their non-disabled counterparts. And they also face a steep pay gap in this country, earning 63 cents on average for every dollar paid to workers without disabilities. But when you add a criminal record into the mix, you're only going to make it harder for people to return to their communities and to achieve stability. And that's because, and Sharon Dietrich could do this if she were sitting up here from Community Legal Services, my former boss who deserves a shout out, nearly 9 in 10 employers use background checks in hiring, and having even a minor criminal record, even an arrest, that never led to a conviction can be a recipe for having your resume thrown in the trash. And meanwhile, reentry programs all too often lack the needed accommodations and expertise to work with people with disabilities. There's no one single panacea here. We're going to talk a lot about solutions today, but I think one important takeaway is that it's going to take reform and partnership across these communities at every single level of the system. And I'm incredibly proud and honored to be in a room with so many people who are leading on that kind of solution-based thinking, both from the outside and the inside. I'm looking at you, Sheriff Kay. So thank you for being here today, and I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Thank you. Jamila, let's dig into the cell block a little bit. Walk us into what you guys are seeing around the solitary work that I know is something both you and the ACLU are obviously extremely passionate about.
So for the past 5 years, first of all, I just want to say thank you to Rebecca and to the White House for convening this amazing event. It's certainly an important issue, and it's an issue that the ACLU has been concerned about. And I also want to thank the advocates in the room for the incredible work I've learned from many of you all. So here at the Stop Solitary campaign, what we're finding is that there are persons with physical disabilities that are routinely placed into conditions amounting to extreme social and sensory deprivation for many of the same reasons that we read about in the Department of Justice's report, talking about the report and recommendations coming out at the Federal Bureau of Prisons. We're finding that people are placed into isolation because there are, as Rebecca mentioned, a lack of accessible housing for these persons. And so they're placed placed in there. They're denied access to their assistive devices. Many are forced to sort of crawl around their tiny cells for hours on end without access to reasonable accommodations. When we started hearing about these cases at the ACLU, it was very concerning. Why? We have a very comprehensive federal law. The Americans with Disabilities Act ensures reasonable accommodations to persons with disabilities. But unfortunately, this law is not respected in many prisons and jails across the country. So I'll back up. So solitary confinement, as we know, confinement 23 hours a day or more in conditions that are amounting to sensory and social deprivation. We know from research that this has dramatic harms on persons with and without a history of mental illness. But what less research shows and what we're finding out through scholars like Bree Williams out of the University of California at San Francisco is that solitary confinement can be physically debilitating. We're seeing persons that are going into conditions of solitary confinement having and experiencing physical debilitation. They're not getting access to physical therapies, regular and routine physical therapies. They're not receiving access to their prescription medications on a timely basis. One of the persons I spoke with, he has quadriplegia. He requires medication four times a day to prevent seizures. He was placed in conditions of isolation until a jail in Oregon figured out what to do with him, and during this 48-hour period was denied access to his prescription therapies, and as a result had a series of very painful seizures throughout. And so, especially as relates to the accessibility issues, we wanted to highlight that there is no penological justification for these placements for persons with physical disabilities into these conditions of isolation. Now, we've also found that persons are being placed into solitary confinement for some of the more regular and common reasons, disciplinary segregation, administrative segregation where there is a perceived threat to security and safety of the institution. But to think about disciplinary segregation for a minute, as Rebecca mentioned, in many cases, persons that are deaf or hard of hearing are denied access to accommodations to permit them to fully understand what's happening in the disciplinary hearing. And so we're seeing cases where disciplinary proceedings are not accessible, and due to, in some cases, miscommunications, you have persons that will spend time, deaf persons, that will spend time in segregation on charges that are really the basis of a misunderstanding. So these are very concerning to anyone that's, you know, concerned about obviously the rights of those with disabilities, but also procedural due process protections. You can have folks that are sitting in these conditions unjustifiably. So we were very, very concerned at the ACLU when we heard about that. And the last thing that I do want to lift in particular is when we think about the conditions of solitary confinement, and again, as I mentioned, the harms on those with mental illnesses are very well known and are traumatizing, but we really should also expand our scope and think about the harms physically. And I want to lift some of the work that Heard has done and T.L. Lewis and the advocates there, and they've termed some of these experiences as a prison within a prison. If you're in a condition of isolation and you're in a cell that's the size of a parking lot for 22 or more hours a day, you're looking at a cell concrete block that's, you know, tiny for most of the day. That's not much by way of visual stimulation. The sounds that you hear are probably screams or doors, you know, slamming shut. Not by much by way of audio and sensory stimulation. And these have the effect of what Heard has termed to be a prison within a prison. It's difficult to imagine being incommunicado for that long if you don't have access to a sign language interpreter, if all you hear are banging sounds, or if all you see is sort of the cell block around you. We have to really think about what we're doing to human beings and to our commitment to rehabilitation. Solitary confinement, we argue at the ACLU, and many others agree in this room, is not at all in line with our commitment to rehabilitation. And so grateful for the opportunity to share about this additional group of persons that are affected by the practice that we call torture here at the ACLU, and want to, again, lift these narratives and encourage many of you who are already working in this area to continue to focus on physical disabilities as an issue under solitary. Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Jamila. Rebecca Vallis and I were both at Netroots Nation this last week and hearing from folks on the ground as to what they're dealing with. And I think one of the things that really struck me was I was talking to an advocate from outside of Ferguson, and she said, "I am post-post." And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "This is, you know, when the president got elected, folks said it was post-racial." Depending on who gets elected, they might say we're post-gender. She goes, I am post-post. Post is not a thing. She said, I don't have post-traumatic stress disorder. I have traumatic stress disorder. It is something I live with daily. I am not post anything. And it really struck me in terms of how we talk about the experience of folks as they enter the system, but then also their time while in the system and leaving the system, as that trauma just continues. And I think it's important as we think about it, both in terms of folks entering the system with disabilities already, and then as you said, quoting our colleagues at Heard and T.L. Lewis, the jail within the jail, or the prison within the prison, and acquiring additional disabilities while in the system. Sheriff Kay, I'm going to kick it over to you. Talk to us about what you see on the ground. I know we've had conversations this last week about the cycle of repeat customers, as it is. You know, the folks that really have no business in being behind bars, but there are not accessible and affordable community-based solutions to folks. Talk to us about what you're seeing in your community.
Thank you, Rebecca. Firstly, I'd just like to say thank you to the Office of Public Engagement and to the White House and for the Center for American Progress. I mean, I'm kind of giddy, not just because I'm here at the White House speaking, which would make anyone really excited to be invited to do something like this, but by the fact that we're speaking about this as a group today, something that many in this room never would have thought possible over many years and decades, quite honestly. I think about this. I mean, when you think about the president was the first sitting president to visit a correctional facility, it's kind of stunning that no one has done that before that date. Even our own governor of Massachusetts was surprised to learn that this was the first time, and he's already been to institutions a couple of times. The leadership by the president is incredible, and especially when you consider that we're talking about two groups here combined that society forgets about, one the incarcerated and another people with disabilities. And then you combine them into one population, and it's even more extreme, so to speak. So I'll address it, Rebecca, in just the terms of a little bit about the Middlesex Sheriff's Office, a little bit about the problem, a little bit about the effects, and then we can speak about the solutions at a later point during the regular discussion. I've been the sheriff for the last 5 years. I was formerly a prosecutor and a state representative. I was the chairman of the Committee on Health Care that also had the mental health and public health components to that committee at that time. My county, just so you understand the size, of 1.55 million people. It's one of the largest counties in the country. 54 cities and towns, so it's a sprawling county as well, with urban, suburban, and rural communities. And we're a member of the major county sheriffs. Our population snapshot for just today was today we're a little bit down in our count, but 1,122. Jail and sentenced men with us, about 100 women that serve in a different place. 481 were sentenced, and 641 are jail or pretrial detainees. That's what in our shop right now. So what's the problem? You know, you've seen figures up to 2/3 of those in the jail populations on a national level have mental health issues. Let me just tell you about our numbers. 46% of our population in the Middlesex Sheriff's Office have a history of mental health. About 32% are being treated while inside or attended to for mental health needs while they're inside. Sadly, and more problematic is the addiction levels overall, but then when you consider the co-occurrence rates, our co-occurrence rate is about 78%. And that's really hard to extricate how you treat people. That's a real problem. National Alliance for the Mentally Ill in Massachusetts estimated that the state population has a mental health rates of about 25%, county and jailhouse of corrections about 50%, women, incarcerated women, 70%. Let's not forget about certain populations that suffer more. We could also speak about the young adult population, 18 through 24, but we also know that so many of the mental health, first signs of mental health issues start in the early 20s, really. So we're really not going to know. We can't tell who is going to have problems there, but we know it's a whole different population we have to treat very differently in correctional facilities. We are the three largest mental health treatment facilities in the entire country are King, Cook, and LA County jails. It's a sad state of affairs. And we are the largest mental health treatment provider in Middlesex, despite the fact we have a couple of major treatment hospitals in our place. About 33% had some suicidal mention, ideation. We call it Q5, query number 5. 24 individuals reported self-reported cognitive disabilities or intellectual disabilities. That's another issue we have to be considering, but that's self-reporting. New commitments, 26% attempted suicide before incarceration, 47 self-injurious behavior, cutting, burning, headbanging. Part of this is interesting because we're realizing more and more trauma is part of the reason people are ending up in incarceration with mental health issues. We've done a tally of about 20% for had trauma as of in June, 20% for physical abuse, 22% for neglect, 21% for sexual abuse, and 33% for other significant trauma. We're understanding more trauma has more and more effects on people becoming incarcerated. I'll close out by saying this. How do we get to this problem? Well, we started with a deinstitutionalization of people in a probably not a thoughtful way. Should people be institutionalized in these warehouses? Absolutely not. But when we decided to move people out, which we started doing in the late 50s and early 60s, you know, at that time we had about 500 to some maybe 750,000 people that were had been institutionalized or had some type of institutional setting. Now we've got about maybe I've seen 40,000, 70,000 institutional beds out there for people. And the idea was it would be move them out to the community, more humane setting, lower cost, better treatment, but the money never followed the people. So the money never followed them, and additionally, the money was cut. Surprise. Surprise that now jails are the de facto mental health treatment facility and emergency rooms, too. Surprise. Well, we shouldn't be. Our incarceration of mentally ill exacerbates mental health issues, even short term, even if you don't have to go to a restrictive housing segregation or solitary confinement site, whatever you want to call it, even without going to that, it exacerbates existing mental health issues. It does not protect public safety because it disrupts the treatment, it disrupts your housing, it disrupts your job status, and it increases, thereby increasing recidivism. Pretty easy. And it's unsustainable as far as the fiscal impact as well. It's more money for meds in our shop and elsewhere. More often for meds, those with mental health issues tend to stay in our places 3 times longer than those without. And especially when you consider that they continue to recidivate and come back and come back and come back over and over again, even with alternatives that are less expensive and more effective. And then lastly, I'll say this. I'm really proud of the programming that we provide in the Middlesex Sheriff's Office and the treatment we provide. I think it's thoughtful, sensitive, progressive, really where we should be as a nation. But the program we can provide for people with mental health is just not there. You know, we can provide programming for education and vocational opportunities and parenting and especially addiction, right? We can provide programming for that and then pass it off on the outside. But inside, all we can do is evaluate, stabilize, and then set it up so that hopefully we can do a soft handoff, a thoughtful handoff on the way out. But we don't choose who comes to see us, and we don't choose who gets released at what time. That just happens. So our real solutions, as we'll speak about, are, you know, prior to coming to us and as they leave us in places of incarceration. Thank you.
Okay, I'm kicking it over to Dave. David, can you talk to us about how data really comes into play in both sort of highlighting the problem and also informing reforms?
Absolutely. Thank you, Rebecca. And also thanks to the Center for American Progress. There's two Rebeccas on this panel.
Other Rebecca,
yeah. Jedi Rebecca.
We refer to it as a singularity.
Yeah, I like that. We actually have a team here that works on this that we call informally JEDI, Justice Evidence Data Innovation. So we're glad to have everyone on this panel part of the team JEDI. We're here at the White House these last few weeks with heavy hearts because of unimaginable challenges that we've been facing, that the country has been facing as a result. Families have been facing in Dallas, in Baton Rouge, in Minnesota. And so I say this couldn't come at a more appropriate time. The one police chief we've gotten to know well, who's a leader on data, on open data, and on tackling these problems, is Sheriff David O. I'm sorry, Police Chief David O'Brown from Dallas. Many of you have seen him. He's been in the news quite a bit lately. He's someone that we routinely invite to the White House because he's a leader on these issues, implicit bias training, crisis intervention training for mental health populations. They have reduced uses of force and complaints of uses of force dramatically. And so here's someone who is, you know, virtually doing everything right. He said something that I think is very relevant to this community. He's quoted in the New York Times talking about the impossible demands on police officers. He says, every societal failure we put off onto the cops to solve. Not enough mental health funding? Let the cop handle it. Not enough drug addiction funding? Let's give it to the cops. If schools fail, and including mental health programs and disability programs at schools, give it to the cops. Let's give it to the cops to solve that as well. Here's someone who's a leader who understands these problems, and that's a call for help. And I think for the people in this room, it's also a call to action. You already know these challenges. You're taking them on. You understand the deep connection between disability and mental health, policing and incarceration. And so I will quickly share with you one action that we're undertaking, which is called the Data-Driven Justice Initiative that Valerie Jarrett announced just 2 weeks ago, and is a coalition of willing communities, bipartisan, nonpartisan communities across the country, states and counties primarily, signed off on by their chief executives. So the goal of the Data-Driven Justice Initiative is primarily to reduce unnecessary incarceration in the United States. In particular, it's focused on the jail population that sheriffs oversee, and that Peter is a leader on. So, close to 12 million people are in and out of jail each year. That's about 18 times the prison population. And Data-Driven Justice Initiative is about reducing unnecessary incarceration by delivering data-driven, evidence-based solutions focused on two populations that are overrepresented in U.S. jails. Rebecca's report that just came out today will show what 39.9% of folks in jail have some significant disability. Huge portion of them, of course, as the sheriff was mentioning, are mental health disabilities, mental health challenges. So we are focused on that population and also another population that's very relevant for this community, which is folks who are in jail pretrial and are in jail not because they're a risk to the community, not because they're a risk to not show up for a court date, but because they don't have the money to pay bail. So our DOJ numbers are that about 63% of people in jail are in jail pretrial. Huge portion of them are in jail because they can't afford to pay bail. So we're focused on, through DDJ, communities across the country are committing to take up evidence-based practices to reduce the incarceration of these individuals, where incarceration is unnecessary, as it often is. So in particular, for the mental health population, communities are committing to take steps to do two things. One is link data across systems to better understand who the high-need individuals and super-utilizer individuals are. Linking data across the criminal, some element of the criminal justice system and the health or mental health system so that we can get out in front of the problem. We've seen when we are able to link this data, we are able to identify that population and provide alternative treatments that prevent the rest in the first place. It's been incredible to see that Denver and Santa Clara County, which includes San Jose, fourth largest homeless population in the United States, they've linked this data, and they are able to not only intervene in advance, but they know in real time whether the interventions are working. Let's say permanent supportive housing is provided to the individual with a mental health disability. Frank may have been getting arrested three times a week and going to the emergency room four times a month, and by linking this data, we identify Frank, provide him upfront solution, and we also know if it's working. Does he stop getting arrested? Does he stop going to jail? Does he stop going to the emergency room? It's really incredible to see the results, and it is in part through these types of solutions, communities that are doing this, are seeing precipitous declines in their jail populations and unnecessary incarceration of this population. The second thing that we're asking communities to do, and the communities are committing to do, is pre-arrest diversion. We shouldn't be using our jail system as a way, a source of treatment for people who are in mental health crisis. Sheriffs know this. Leaders know this. Police officers are not trained, as David Brown, Chief Brown so eloquently put it, are not trained to be social workers typically. But what they've done, there's many examples, but one thing they've done in Miami, which is a DDJ community, is they've trained all their 911 dispatchers and their line officers in crisis intervention training. They've done this for over 5 years. Over 5 years, they've had 50,000 911 calls or other calls of service involving flagged as a mental health challenge. 50,000. They've only made 109 arrests. Again, precipitous drop. They've created an alternative facility other than jail for this population, basically repurposing an emergency room, providing better supports. They have drastically, of course, reduced unnecessary uses of force, reduced unnecessary incarceration, and in the process, they've saved, their estimates is they're saving $12 million a year by diverting folks from jail. So we want more communities to do that. Last, and the communities in the Data Driven Justice Initiative are committing to do so. The last component is the folks who are held pretrial. We know there are evidence-based solutions, risk-based assessment tools, where we can determine, is a person a risk to the community or themselves? Is the person a risk to not show up back for a court date? If not, all the evidence suggests that communities are safer, better, and more stable if we let the person go back into the community. As the sheriff was mentioning, if this population, many of which have co-incurrence of mental health challenges or other disabilities, if they have any connection to work, they lose that employment. It's not, they don't have the kinds of jobs where they can, you know, be in jail for a few, 4 or 5 days and come back. If they have family responsibilities, they lose those, or they let their family down. And we know it's not making communities safer. So communities are committing to take up evidence-based, risk-based assessment tools so that we can return folks to community and not over-incarcerate. So that is the summary of the President's Data-Driven Justice Initiative, and we're thrilled to have this community here to build awareness. And I know that Middlesex County, we have not yet had the opportunity, Sheriff, to share that with you. We're so thrilled with this engagement of so many sheriffs around the country. So let's talk about
that. Getting in touch with you guys about that.
That is perfect. Excellent. Great. Thank you very much. And thanks to all of you for coming and for all of the incredibly important work that you do on behalf of this population, as the sheriff points out, is too often doesn't get the attention that it deserves and merits.
Dave, I know you are. You might have to exit shortly, so we'll just really quickly, if you guys could go down the line and highlight one success or one best practice that you are seeing thus far in your work as it relates to criminal justice reform and people with disabilities.
Do you want to start?
I've got a little time. I pushed back there.
So I've got a whole bunch I can point to, but I don't want to take up all the time here. So I'm hoping that there'll be more questions afterwards I can address them as need be. One of the main things that I'd say that, you know, we led the fight in Massachusetts is the issue of Medicaid and coverage. Healthcare coverage, right? This is a really important one. I can speak about, you know, pre-arrest and post-arrest and pre-incarceration and post-incarceration solutions. I can do that at some other point, but one thing that we have to remember is medical coverage is really important to a person's stability and health in a community, overall health in a community, and the health of a community. President should be lauded. You know, this ACA expansion captures so many more of those people that are criminally justice involved overall. It's kind of like it was meant for those that are criminally justice involved. It's based, you know, as a single, based upon income levels. Just for instance, our uninsurance rate, which I know would be the envy of the nation overall, is about 2 to 3%. But the incarcerated, the criminal justice involved population, about 26% that we see coming into our place. So you can see a need, a stark need right there in a population. If you can address them, then you can really bring that down. It's really important, especially when you consider addressing issues of addiction and mental health services. This is a term I call, I didn't copy it from anyone, but someone else might be using it, but I call it medical recidivism. Because if you can get people on with health care, especially with mental health and substance abuse counseling, Washington State study found that they were 33% less likely to recidivate. So as we get people on, and what we've started doing in Massachusetts, there's like 20-some-odd states that still aren't expansion states, but we began the suspension versus termination. So when they come in, the theory, as we're trying to integrate, get the system up and running, the systems are really hard to get up to date as quickly as the great ideas that we have, is that we can actually sign, when they used to come in, they'd come into our jail and they'd be terminated from Medicaid, shut off completely. No file, just stop. And then when they get out, they'd have to go sign back up again, which most people wouldn't do. It would take too long. The sophistication was difficult. Yeah. So what we did, we actually now sign them up. The theory is, as we do this, is that we sign them up when they come in for Medicaid. We then immediately suspend them, which we can do. And then as they're either have an inpatient stay at a hospital that can be very expensive for us, or they're actually then stepping out, we activate them again. That way they have the seamless coverage. And this continuity of coverage is crucially important to people's well-being, especially within the people with disabilities community.
Great. Shamila?
In terms of reform in the carceral setting, I definitely want to put a plug in for the amazing work of the National PNA Networks, in particular the work of Disability Rights Washington. You'll hear from Rachel a little bit later today, but they've done amazing work in terms of partnering and pressuring at the same time departments of corrections to really improve their treatment of persons with disabilities. And in terms of reforms that we've seen work, where a state system has an ADA coordinator, someone that's aware of the ADA, knows the law, can conduct trainings, can ensure that they have a seat at the table when it comes to determining the appropriate, along with the prisoner, of course, the appropriate reasonable accommodation. We've found that those systems actually tend to accommodate better. And another thing that we also see is very important, in addition to, you know, cultural sensitivity trainings or things on that order, is really understanding that the ADA requires individualized consideration. And in many cases, that might not fit with, the security models of corrections institutions there to control and command. So we found that there are correction systems that have very enlightened views of how to work with persons with disabilities, and they've been successful in ensuring equal access to programming and services and other activities under the ADA. So there's certainly some success stories out there, and I think that's really the result of many partnerships with folks in this room and other disability rights organizations working with these departments.
Thank you, Rebecca. Other Rebecca.
Oh,
you turned me off. I had it. I got this now. Okay. Well, it's good thing you're not in charge of data. Okay. Oh, wait, you are. we're friends now. So I think we're having a conversation today about the criminal justice system and about criminal justice reform, but I think it needs to be said that first and foremost, we need to invest in community-based services. Right, we've heard, and we've discussed the long history of disinvestment in those services, and the inextricable link that has to the overrepresentation of people with disabilities in jails and prisons. But we can't lose sight of the fact that investment on the front end, before we're even talking about the criminal justice system, has to be step one of what we need to be working together to do. That's going to range from outpatient treatment to peer support, case management, supportive housing, mobile crisis teams. There are a lot of proven and cost-effective tools that prevent entry into the criminal justice system before it happens. And I will put a plug in, as we are having a criminal justice reform conversation in states and cities across this country, in addition to in Washington, states and cities are going to be seeing savings from those reforms because they're going to be seeing reduced incarceration. What I would propose, and what CAP has come out strongly in favor of, along with other partners in this room, is reinvesting those cost savings from reduced incarceration into the community-based prevention services that will keep people out of jails and prisons in the first place. Now, continuing in a discussion about community, I think another point that has to be made is that while training is absolutely critical at every point in the system and for all personnel in the system, training can only be one part of a much larger agenda. We need to be very careful not to check the box and say, oh, we're done here. We've done that training now. The training is critical, and crisis intervention teams are a piece of that incredibly successful model. But what we need to be doing is considering that to be a first step, and a very important first step, that's part of a larger agenda. Disability needs to be a lens that's applied across every aspect of the system and every aspect of reform. So while we're working together with law enforcement, with partners across the system and across the aisle to build a fair and equitable justice system, we need to be thinking about disability as a core component of that reform.
That's great. Now I know how this works. So I think that's a terrific point. I want to follow up on Rebecca said and share. Rebecca Coakley asked for some highlights. So I think one terrific story is the example of Charlotte Mecklenburg, North Carolina, that used a data-based risk assessment tool to identify low-risk people in jail, often folks with disability and mental health challenge. So they've identified this population using a risk-based assessment tool that is data-driven and found ways to release them safely back into the community. As a result, they've enabled to release significantly more low, no-risk individuals. And today, their total, just since 2014 they started doing this, their total jail population has dropped by 40%. So Rebecca was talking about savings alone. I mean, that at that point it's significant, not to mention the impact, positive impact comparatively that you're having on this these folks' lives. And there's been no increase in reported crime. Mm-hmm. Kentucky has done a similar intervention statewide, and they've seen a reduction in misdemeanors since they've increased the release of this population because folks' lives are more stable. So that's really meaningful. The other example I was mentioning, Miami, one stat that I didn't mention that is a result, so you've got these risk-based assessment tools to release folks pre-trial, and then we also have these pre-arrest diversion tools such that people don't come into jail in the first place. Miami's jail population was as a result of diversion tool usage. Their jail population, which was the eighth largest in the country, dropped from 7,800 to 4,400. So it was a big source of their savings there. Imagine if a community does both of these solutions and what the impact can be, and in particular, the positive impact on a population with disability. But it all does come back to community-based solutions. Because we have an initiative within DDJ, we talk about diverting people from jail. This sub-initiative is called Divert to What? We need evidence-based and proven solutions. I visited with the former sheriff of Denver, the Denver jail, a couple of weeks ago. And we also visited a supportive housing program for folks with mental disability where they're diverting folks to. And this is where it gets to the savings. One of the challenges is that there are upfront costs associated with delivering these interventions that drive savings on the back end. So one of the solutions that we really like and that actually Center for American Progress has been a sort of foundational thought leader in is pay for success. The notion of government, multiple agencies, who could be health and a criminal justice agency or a sheriff's department, can say, we will pay for positive outcomes once those positive outcomes are achieved. And then what they can do, and rather than paying for services up front, first of all, we know we're getting to outcomes, which is great. And once the outcomes are achieved, the sheriff's department and the mental health division and the health division, which have realized savings, can take a portion of that savings and pay for the intervention in arrears. And impact investors or others often provide that upfront funding. So that's what Denver has done. That's what Santa Clara has done. Boston has done this to address over-incarceration of the mental health population in particular. So we're very enthusiastic about that. The last thing that I would say, and I might have to go somewhere along here, but all of you are from communities. Data-driven justice initiative that the president and we announced very recently is a place-based solution. It's about community-based leaders committing to take action on proven solutions. There is a list online, whitehouse.gov/data-driven-justice. You can see everyone. It's actually a top link right now on the White House website. If your community is not already a member of Data-Driven Justice, we hope that you'll ask them to consider joining and taking a part. Also, many of you have national platforms, and we hope that you will encourage communities around the country to look at data-driven justice as a solution to help deal with challenges that they want to solve with respect to disability and incarceration. This is a community of practice that connects them with resources, philanthropic and technological and otherwise. So would be very happy to link either through CAP or others for ways of encouraging communities to join this initiative. NAMI, the Coalition for Corporation for Supportive Housing, and many others are backbone partners to this initiative, and we welcome your engagement as well.
Okay, just to wrap things up, because I know we went over, so we don't have time for questions. I think one of the key things that you said, David, that's sticking with me, is the divert to what? You know, I think we know, and I think we've all talked about it to some extent, that the issue of mass incarceration as it relates to all people, but especially tied to people with disabilities, is an issue of poverty, is an issue of lack of accessible and affordable housing, access to health care, as we heard Sheriff Kay talk about. Transportation, which wasn't mentioned, which we know is a key issue when it comes to people with disabilities, accessing jobs, accessing services, access to food. I mean, I was with a colleague recently, and we ended up in this real long, in-depth conversation about food deserts, and someone at the table was like, well, why don't folks move? And it was like, because they're poor.
Yeah.
And I think this conversation is an ignorant conversation if we don't talk about it within the context of poverty, looking at the lens of racism, classism, autism, homophobia, et cetera. You know, and this is a conversation that I would really encourage all my colleagues in the room and the disability community, you guys we just can't have this conversation with ourselves. We've been having this conversation quietly with ourselves for a really long time. Now we need to have it loud and out with our colleagues from the broader civil rights community. And I want to give a special shout out to colleagues from the Civil Rights Coalition on the police reform that are here, Reverend Yearwood and the Hip Hop Caucus that are here and have been to the table with us repeatedly as we continue to talk about issues of the disability community and criminal justice reform. I'd like to thank all of our panelists and thank Maria for pulling together this fabulous event, and we will usher ourselves off the stage so Maria can key up the next speaker. Thank you so much.